Welcome back, family. This week's guest, Rodney Barnes, honored us with a visit on the eve of the debut of two of his most high-profile projects. Marvel's Runaways has been a pun intended runaway success. Rodney serves as executive producer for that popular Hulu show. If you haven't seen it, check it out. If you love Marvel, it's definitely up your lane. And equally as impressive, Rodney was also tapped to be the writer of the relaunch of the Falcon comic book, the ongoing Marvel series chronicling the adventures of one of their bigger stars. Now, we're incredibly excited about this interview. We can't wait for you to listen to it as well. So check it out. And then, as always, let us know what you think. So we do this for you, our family, and we're promising that 2018 is going to be bigger than ever. So without any further ado, let's go.
Once again, thank you for doing this. And for those who, for some reason, don't know who you are, please tell everybody who you are and how you got to where you are.
Two pretty diverse questions. I am a writer, producer, I guess author. Well, screenwriter, producer, author. I write, primarily known for writing television shows like Everybody Hates Chris, My Wife and Kids, The Boondock. Just wrote a show, Runaways, for Marvel. Worked on a lot of films, writing comic books for Marvel, a myriad of things. How did I get here? I've been working on this.
Let me see if I can ease that one for you. No one's born. Well, no, let me take that back. People are born writers, but not everybody is able to put their thoughts in a coherent fashion. When did you decide that this is what you wanted to do? And how did you shape yourself?
I had a teacher in eighth grade, a guy by the name of Jay Silverberg. He's no longer with us. He challenged me to, I was kind of like the class clown in school, and to kind of put me in my place, he gave me an assignment, a writing assignment for the school newspaper. And I wasn't going to let him beat me. Or make me look stupid. So I really put some effort into it. And turns out after I wrote it, he said, you know, if you ever were to take writing seriously, I think you could be a really good writer. So it kind of planted a seed in my head that, hey, maybe one day I could be a writer. I always had a relationship with words. Always loved literature. Literature and book, whatever form, book form, comic book, magazines, whatever, loved to read. Loved media. Television and film, and so you know, it just all kind of coalesced through life, really. I mean, when you say writers aren't born, I think I actually, there was nothing else really for me to do but this. I can't think of another thing that I would do, so I think it chose me. I didn't choose it.
So did you go to school to be a writer?
I did study at Howard, radio, TV, and film. But I think most of my learning or training actually came from actually doing it. You know, the crude stuff you do in the beginning when you're trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of personal study and then ultimately evolving over the course of time. You know, once you start doing it practically, where there's a, you know, there's a standard that you have to be held to, and then that launches into actually becoming, refining that raw thing of wanting to do a thing into actually being a writer, you know, where you get paid for it. I was trying to avoid saying get paid for it.
Hey, everything has to have some type of income attached to it, so getting paid is nothing wrong with it.
Yes.
Speaking of getting paid, you finished school, you went to Howard. At what point did you decide you couldn't pursue your dreams here on the East Coast?
I was working on movies,
mm-hmm,
in the Baltimore, D.C., Virginia area, and I was working on a movie, Major Pain.
Okay.
I was working with Damon Wayans. I was production assistant, and he gave me an opportunity to work on. I worked on Celtic Pride, worked on a couple of other movies with him, and I worked on a movie, Bulletproof, in L.A. with him.
Uh-huh.
And one day on set, he was like, you know, if you ever really want to be a writer and you take this seriously, you got to come to L.A. And I took his advice, lived in my car for about 8 months, and moved to L.A.
So once you landed here, what set you on your feet, so to speak? What got you to be a steady working writer?
Marriage and ultimately divorce.
Mm-hmm.
I had to take care of a family, and you know, it just became a thing of where I started looking at it not just from a creative place, but also from a business place, and I kind of made a correlation between writers who worked a lot versus writers who didn't work a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like you had some writers who were kind of at the mercy of whoever would hire them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I figured that if I could diversify my business and do more than just like sitcoms were my first opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
But if I could develop my storytelling ability to a place where I could do a myriad of things, then I could stay employed. And so it went from working on sitcoms to then working in animation, working on dramas, working on films, commercials, reality. I mean, I think if you look at my resume, I've done a lot of different things.
Mm.
And a lot of that is, you know, my lawyer, Daryl Miller, has this philosophy about having 7 streams of income. And so I try to take, like, I'm doing this video game now, writing video games. So it's like comic books, video games, television, film, drama, comedy, animation, all of those different things. They're all storytelling. It's just different ways of telling the story. So I try to look at the business as much as I look at the show.
Now, you've mentioned a lot of different genres that you're in, from drama to action to sitcoms. I don't know if we can call the comic books a genre, superhero film, if you will. That's a lot of different hats to wear. Is it hard to separate what part of your mind works on what, or does all of it kind of flow from the same place?
It all flows from the same place. I just look at it as stories. Some of them you tell comedically, some of them dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
According to, you know, I'm doing a horror film next year. So it's like, it's just telling a story and deciding what that story requires. And I think even in drama, I'm going to have 7 to 10 jokes anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it's more of, in each genre, I'm coming from a real place anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
It's just where that place takes you creatively. Does it take you in a humorous place? Does it take you in a dramatic place? Does it take you in a horrifying place? It's still telling story. It's all story.
At the same time as you were writing, you also started kind of picking up producing as well. How did you first get into, who approached you and said they want you to be a producer on the show as well?
Well, when you write in on sitcoms, you kind of you work on your stuff, but then you're working on other people's episodes as well, and it kind of, they go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
So, it kind of comes together. But on some shows, like with Everybody Hates Chris,
mm-hmm.
I actually wrote the voiceover and placed it in the show as well, and recorded Chris Rock doing it, and that was more producing on Life of Kids. It really was just writing.
Okay.
So it really, it's more about the show and what the show's needs are. But when you get to a certain place as a writer, it kind of comes with it. If you're doing television writing, you produce the stuff that you're actually writing in film. When you write a script, it's almost like you're providing a service. You write your script, you give it to the producers, and they go off and they do a thing. In television, you produce what you write.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a different relationship. They kind of go hand in hand.
So you've been all over the map with the shows that you've been a part of. And there's so many that I can't actually list all of them, but I just want to go some highlights. Obviously, My Wife and Kids and Everybody Hates Chris. One of my favorites, Till Death, which I thought was criminally underrated, and really loved that show. And then you have The Boondocks, which for a certain group of us, The Boondocks was life. We waited for those episodes. We bought the DVDs. What was that experience like?
It was a lot of fun, especially in the beginning. I mean, it was free because I only knew network television where there were boundaries.
Uh-huh.
And on that show, there were no boundaries, at least in the beginning. And creatively, you could just say virtually anything. And I thought that for my contribution, the part that I contributed to it, it was freeing to be able to just think of something and do it.
Uh-huh.
Whereas with television, you think of something and hope that you can do it. So, you know, because you never know what standards and practices or, you know, you can't use profanity, you can't say certain things. And, you know, and commercial television is about selling product, cars and laundry detergent. Cable television is more about the creating. So it was my first foray into being able to work on a show where creativity was actually the first thing and not trying to get around censors and that type of thing. So it was fun. And to be able to talk about the culture in a way that was specific and nuanced, where, you know, sometimes in network television at that time, it wasn't about nuance. You know, you were just telling stories. Whether it was a family show or talking about the family, and maybe you could get a couple of things in that were specific to the culture.
Mm-hmm.
The Boondocks was all about the culture, and you were able to talk interculturally, which you don't often get, whether you're on cable or network television. Oftentimes, on network television, if you're talking about race, you're talking about your relationship to outside other cultures outside of you.
Mm-hmm.
But with the Boondocks, we were able to talk inside of the culture. You know, we were able to talk to each other, whether that was, you know, subjective as to whether or not you dig it. You know, for the people who like it, they really seem to like it.
Mm-hmm.
For others, you know, they may take it as it was mean-spirited or whatever. But I'm proud of my time on it. I think it was a quality show.
Kind of led into my next question. I was going to ask what the reception from people who knew you, like, I personally related to it wholeheartedly. I mean, it was funny, and it was that kind of funny that it's funny because it's true. And but was there a lot of backlash that you guys received, or was it a lot of positive reviews? How did that go?
You know, it's kind of a blur now because it was so long ago.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed to be positive. I mean, it seemed to be more love than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so more love than anything else,
okay,
from my vantage. Yeah.
So from there, it's kind of, you've gone reality. You did some work with HBO. The Academy Awards, how'd that come about?
My relationship with Chris Rock.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote, you know, we developed a relationship on Everybody Hates Chris and ultimately a friendship. And I'm fortunate enough that he includes me on, you know, a lot of the stuff that he does. And we have a good relationship. So when he hosted, you know, most of the people that wrote on the show had some form of a relationship with him. And I've just been honored enough to be able to be a part of that.
I think, was that at the same time a friend of the show, Allison, was there?
We worked together on it. I worked with Allison. Allison was there my first day in the business. Allison worked with me on My Wife and Kids. We sat next to each other.
Okay.
My Wife and Kids. She then and now has been a big supporter and a great friend, one of my best friends.
Mm-hmm.
We're very close. As our Facebook friends will attest, because she tortures me on Facebook. Every time I post something on Facebook, I take a deep breath, and I always say, what's her response going to be? So it's unfair that person has that much power over my life and my social media business, but she does. And she has tortured me for years, but I love her. Don't tell her I said I love her, but I do.
Allison may be one of legitimately the funniest people I've ever spoken to. Great friend of the show.
She sure is. Yes, she's fantastic. I love her. She is my work wife.
Uh-huh.
Even though it's an abusive domestic violence relationship, because she has scratched me, punched me, and treated me horribly over a good 20 years now. But for some reason, I keep coming back from this.
That's how you know it's love.
Or if they don't have an adult CPS or somebody that can come and save me, somebody needs a... This could be my cry for help right now.
We're going to have to put a panic button just embedded right underneath the skin.
Exactly. Exactly.
Tell me about Runaways. And that's going to lead into... First, let me say, in the last, I'll say, 10 years, probably since the filming of Iron Man, it's become acceptable to like comics. So I want to ask first, did you always like comics?
Yes, I've loved comic books my entire life. I have I probably learned how to graphic storytelling, you know, not just like spot and Curious George and Ping the Duck and all that. I was never really interested in those books as a kid. I always gravitated to Batman and Superman. And when I was a kid, it was always artists like Neil Adams and Mike Grell and those guys. It's like the art always appealed to me.
Right.
And that kind of my love of reading started with comic books. And so putting the image with the movement and actually the moral through line gave me some semblance of it grounded me in a weird way. And emotionally, comic books just became a part of my life at really 4 or 5 years old. My mother was a school teacher, and she would do her lesson plans at the public library. And there were a box of comic books in the corner. And I knew where they were, and I could sit there for hours and just read and read and read. And regardless of whether things were going great in my life or they were difficult, there always seemed to be comic books there for me to lose myself in. And the great thing about it, too, is they evolved as I was growing up. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, there was superhero stuff purely. But then books like Watchmen, The Dark Knight, Returns, and, you know, the more adult fare came along, like right when I was 17, 18 years old. And it became as much literature as regular books.
Right.
So, you know, it was the perfect timing as I was born for comic books to become what they've become.
It's weird that you say it like that. When I first discovered comics myself, it started with DC. And as I got older, Marvel was more realistic, and it was still, I could bring an X-Men book to school and it wouldn't be weird. So
exactly.
I think
comics,
it was
still
like
weird
video
when
games.
I was growing up. I'm older than you. I can tell that I'm older than you. And I got beat up when I had my comic books in school.
No.
So I had to hide my comic books. My Stephen King and my comic books were two things that I had to hide as a kid. So the fact that you could bring your X-Men, I'm actually jealous of you at this moment.
Hey, look, when Image started, I somehow, don't know how, convinced my mom to drive around town so I could get every number one and Spider-Man number one, and took them to school, and people were jealous. So, yeah.
Your mother loved you more than my mother loved me. I couldn't. I had to wait. They had a liquor store. They had a Spiral comic rack at the liquor store, and I had to wait until it came out. And, you know, it wasn't that much structure to my collective abilities at that time.
Now, let me be clear. She did not enjoy the trip. And I heard every moment of that trip how much she didn't enjoy it. But it still happened.
But that, see, my mother hasn't been uncomfortable in my name since birth. So I don't think the fact that your mother complained, but still, you know, that's probably why you're doing the good work you're doing today.
Shout out to Mom. So from there, learning how to structure a comic from reading them. How does that lead into where you are currently?
Which part?
Well, let's do Runaways, because I think Runaways is going to be something people aren't used to. For one, it's on an on-demand platform, which is, I think this may be the first one outside of like the Netflix arena that's going to be living on on-demand platform. But Runaways is not your typical superhero story.
No, it's not. It's a different thing. But I think it still functions from a place of where comic books, where I guess more of independent comics come from.
Mm-hmm.
Where independent comics come from. It's layered, it's dense, but it's still fun.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still comics. Mm-hmm. It's just a different type of, it takes you to a different place than I would say some of the Netflix stuff does.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still a satisfying comics journey.
Am I going to get the dinosaur?
Yes, you're going to get the dinosaur.
Hey, look, man, I'm sold.
Yeah. I think you'll enjoy it from everything I've seen.
Mm. Well, for everyone, we're talking about Runaways as if it's a known book, and I apologize. Runaways is the story of a group of kids who had normal lives and discovered that their parents weren't who they thought they were. And I don't want to give away the whole hook, but it has to be read or seen to actually understand it completely. But it will catch you almost from the first moment, because it's not what you are used to seeing from a comic book or a comic book adaptation.
Very true. Very true.
Now, I would be remiss and kick myself if I didn't mention that you were the writer of The Falcon.
I am the writer of The Falcon.
The first African-American superhero, the first one that a lot of us saw outside of someone like the Black Panther, who he wasn't all the way relatable to, you know, some of us. He was good. He was black. We loved him. But the Falcon lived in Harlem.
He did.
How do you become the writer of the Falcon?
I think it's a little bit of luck. I think it's because, you know, my first business with the company was Runaways, and I made it known that I wanted to be a part of the publishing side of the company. And they read some of my stuff. They liked what they saw. And the opportunity came, and I took it.
Mm.
That's it. I mean, I had to pitch, you know, what I thought a good storyline would be, and they went with my pitch. But, you know, really it wasn't, I won't say it wasn't difficult,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, once you're in the company and once you make it known that, you know, you want to be a part of it, they're going to at least give you a look and an opportunity.
Now, the Falcon is not a character that has, you know, a short backstory. You've got decades worth of lifting on your shoulders. Is that harder than walking in and creating somebody new, or was it just more room for you to play?
It was more room for me to play. I mean, the part that made it semi-difficult was that Nick Spencer, the writer of Secret Empire,
mm-hmm.
had done so much great work with Sam as Captain America and, you know, in different generations and, you know, the writers of the Avengers where Sam was leading the Avengers. You
mm-hmm.
know, there was so much stuff done with him that now when you take him back to a grassroots character, you can't just have him, you know, getting criminals off the corner
right.
and chasing drug dealers. You
right.
know, you got to give him something to do. So, you know, when I'm thinking, it's like I can't make him just a regular guy. You need apocalyptic implications. You need big, big terrain, big ideas, regardless of the setting. And for me, what I'd always, it was a love-hate relationship with characters of color as a kid, because it always seemed like all they talked about was being black.
Mm.
And their adventures were kind of sidebar adventures. You know, they would fight the Klan, and they would fight gangs, and they would fight, you know, it wasn't the same as you weren't going to get heroes who they weren't going to immediately fight Thanos.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they weren't going to immediately fight Red Skull. You know, they were going to fight whoever was within their power room.
Mm-hmm.
And so my pitches really spawned from, as a kid, what I wanted to see. So
I remember picking up a Luke Cage comic. This was probably, 95, 96, and I remember thinking every issue was Luke Cage was reconciling his blackness, and I kept thinking to myself,
exactly,
that's not what we do. I don't wake up in the morning,
exactly,
and validate my blackness.
Exactly. And so there are adventures that you're probably not going to go on because you're talking about that thing. And even if you do go on the adventure I want you to go on, I got to step away from that adventure to be reminded that you're black.
Right. Right.
You know, where I see that you're black. So
it's unavoidable.
It's right there. So, you know, for me to be able to, I touch on social stuff, but I go into another place than a place I've always wanted to go with this kind of character.
So moving back into the television film world, I see you've got some upcoming projects, and the one that that stood out to me was Heels. And can you explain a little bit about what Heels is to everyone?
Heels is about a small professional wrestling outfit in a federation in Georgia, small town wrestling. If you're a fan of wrestling, the guy's bringing my food.
Oh, no problem.
It's about a small wrestling organization in Georgia, and about a family run organization, and it's basically trying to maintain the family while trying to maintain the business at the same time and dealing with pro wrestling.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you're setting up something like this, and that's something I meant to ask you earlier, with all the different types of shows you've done, how do you do the research for these type of things? Because pro wrestling is not Runaways. It's not My Wife and Kids. How much work goes into the building of these characters?
I mean, the thing for me is it's all stuff. You know, it's funny. I told my son this a few months ago. I've been fortunate that I worked on the show Vinyl for HBO,
mm-hmm,
and I love music. So I really didn't have to do a whole lot of research. You know, some of the storylines were music themed and the type of music that I was listening to as a younger person.
Mm-hmm.
And then I do a show based in the world of comic books, and I've always loved comic books, and I've always loved pro wrestling too.
Mm-hmm.
So these are things that kind of play to my strengths.
Okay.
And, you know, I really didn't have to do a whole lot of research. I've been watching wrestling. I was watching wrestling with my grandfather for as long as I can remember, and grew up with it, all of the different iterations of it. Actually wrestled for a short, incredibly short period of time. got beaten mercilessly, and decided that wasn't for me. But writing is much safer, you know. But it was, all of these things have been a part of my life, and so I found that when you write from a place that you know, it becomes, the writing is a lot more organic and emotionally connected in a different kind of way. Then I've had gigs where, you know, you're in it and you have to do a lot of research and you have to do a lot of heavy lifting. And, you know, I've had a couple of gigs where I just couldn't jump in. You know, like Double Dutch and Waiting to Jump In,
mm-hmm,
where I just couldn't get what they were trying to do. They were speaking another language, and it just didn't fit. And that's really only happened once or twice, but it kind of taught me to stay in a place where I at least am emotionally connected to the characters and or the world that I'm playing in. And so far I've been fortunate enough, and at this point in my career, I'm fortunate enough to where everything that I'm doing right now is really subject matter that I'm emotionally connected to and characters that I'm emotionally connected to.
Mm-hmm. So when can we expect Heels?
Don't know.
Okay.
That's up to Stars. We've written all the scripts, waiting for them to make a decision. I'm working on a bunch of stuff on my own right now.
Mm.
So the got a show in development with T.I. and Jerry Bruckheimer for Fox.
Two very small names. People have never heard of
them.
Yeah.
Yes. That's my, I guess, the majority of my time between comic books is that and a couple of other. I'm developing the video game Street Fighter, the series for a company.
Mm-hmm. Like Street Fighter of the classic
the video game.
Okay.
Yeah, the game. I'm doing Cooley High, doing the reboot of Cooley High. I got a bunch of stuff. Got my hands in.
So I guess that brings me to the next question, and I think you've pretty much answered it, but what is next?
Well, there's that. I mean, some of the stuff I can't talk about.
Okay.
Because they got to talk about it first.
Mm.
But there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff. It's 2-3 more comic books, 2-3 more movies, 2-3 more pilots. I'm going to be working for the next 8 months straight. I won't be able to come outside when all the other kids are playing in the street. I'm going to be looking out of the window like that scene in Mo Better Blues. When
right.
All the other kids are playing ball. That's me. It's a lovely problem to have, but it's certainly no fun.
First world problems.
Exactly. There you go. There you go.
So let me ask you this then. What do the next 5 years hold for you?
I mean, I hope I'm able to continue to stay in a place where I'm doing things that speak to creatively what ultimately I want to be, which is emotionally connected to the material. I love being able to write from, you know, Hollywood buys voices.
Mm-hmm.
They don't necessarily buy writers. It's like people have, when you talk about Allison has a very specific voice. And I do as well. And so anytime I can write to that, I can work within that space, I think I'm doing my best work. And so if I can continue to do that for 5 years and into the future, whether it's on my series or a series that, you know, I happen to be a part of, that's what I want to do. Or film and in comic books, you know, I want to continuously be active and doing what I'm doing as long as I can possibly do it.
And let me say once again, it's an honor to have you on the show. Your resume is amazing. And for you to take the time out to speak with us, I really appreciate it. Want to say welcome to the family. Unfortunately, Allison is also in the family, so you're not getting away from her.
Well, actually, Allison was the one. She told me I didn't have a choice, so it's almost like a bully taking your lunch money. Allison has punched and scratched my left arm so much that I probably can't lift it over my head. So I only have the right arm for her to attack. So I really didn't. I would have loved to have not done this, but she told me I had no choice. So, you know, it was, you can blame her.
Well, if you see her, you tell her I still have love for her.
Well, I appreciate that, even though I'm trying to duck her, like I said, the bully in the neighborhood. I'm trying to duck her, but she keeps finding me.
Hey, look, so, man, sometimes people are brought into our lives for the pain and the bonus, the benefits.
That's very, very true. I'm waiting for the benefit of my relationship with her to pop up.
We'll
I'm going to take your word that it's coming. Yes. But there you go.
And by cut there that out, I mean emphasize it with reverb.
Oh, yeah, that's fine. Here's a man. I'm not scared of Allison. Terrified of
her. Look,
she has a vein in her forearm that's actually the scariest thing I've ever seen in my life.
When she told me the story of how she got the job on my wife and kid, no, I'm sorry, on Keenan's show, I think I might have laughed every time I listened back to it. When I was editing, I would have to pause because I was crying. She's legitimately one of the funniest people. If anyone has not heard Allison, go back and listen to her interview. She is one of the funniest people that I've ever spoken to.
She is.
And she smart.
She's crazy.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, a little bit of crazy, everybody needs that.
They say a lot of serial killers are geniuses. So, so
I'm not saying she is a serial killer, but, you know, people
I'm
tend to disappear.
Her. This is, well, or they cry. They end up crying. Mm. Allison has a way. Allison doesn't have the ability to play. So when you try to joke with Allison, she's going to go right for the jugular. There is no, don't try to wrestle her. Don't hug her. If she's not looking at you, coming towards her. There's a lot of, she's frightening individual. She's frightening individual.
Well, with all that pre-warning, Allison, I love you. I've never said a bad word about you. And
exactly.
You know,
don't be scared now. Don't be scared. You know, you're just as scared as I am, but go ahead.
You know what? Allison be saying sit down, and I do it. But when she leave, I stand up again.
Yeah, well, then there you go. See, you know? I sit down the whole time, and I wait until she drives off. And then I still wait another 30 seconds.
In case she doubles
and
back.
Then I get it. Oh, yeah, because she will double back. She's like a horror movie. Now you think it's over, and she comes back. That's out.
Mm. Look, you got to come back. You have to come back.
Oh, happy.
Anytime you have anything you want to promote, consider this your microphone.
I appreciate that. I really do.
Once again, thanks to Rodney Barnes for stopping by the Brownstone and speaking with us. Check him out. Check out his work on Marvel's Runaways on Hulu. Check out his work on Falcon Comic from Marvel Comics. Check out some of his previous work, The Boondocks, My Wife and Kids, on and on and on. Definitely someone to be following. Once again, we also want to thank you for just a spectacular 2017. You guys are everything to us, and we do everything for you. Please let us know what you want to hear, who you want us to talk to. Check us out on Instagram. Check us out on the web. Check us out on Spotify. We do this for you, family, and once again, love.